Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October sometime. And on the schedule I see it says October 4th. We got our second lecture in cell respiration today. Oh, my goodness. We only got two lectures on cell respiration? Okay. We might need three. I'm not sure. We'll see how far we can get. And your next lecture test is what? Two weeks from Monday. Wait. Let's see. Two weeks from Tuesday. On the 23rd. All right, and that's on chapters 4, 5, and 7, and we're going to get into 7 really soon. All right, do you have any questions so far? If you did any studying, did you guys do any studying on cell respiration yet? Okay, probably it's a good idea that you do because you don't want to get behind in this class. All right, so let's start the lecture. If I need to say anything, let me go back to the first slide right here. Okay, you guys are a little rowdy this morning, but I can turn up the microphone and just talk over everybody. So don't be too loud. As a matter of fact, don't even talk to each other because somebody next to you might be trying to listen and you might disturb what they're thinking about and listening to. All right, so let's go to here, and what else? Ah, lights. So you can see the slides. Too much. So let's go back to that very first slide, which was something that you should commit to memory. All right, this one right here. Let's talk about this as an overview of where we are in this chapter. So you should be able to commit this one to memory. All right, so don't forget, there are two different states taking place right here. When you're in a fed state, then your body is absorbing glucose from your gastrointestinal tract and putting it in the blood, maintaining blood glucose levels. When you are in a fasted state, blood glucose levels are going to decrease naturally, but there's an organ in your body that will maintain blood glucose, and that's the liver. The liver will break down, I was thinking about what I was going to say, the liver will break down glycogen, right? And the basic building block of glycogen is glucose, and there is a glucose 6-phosphatase in the liver, which takes the phosphate off of glucose 6-phosphate, and you have free glucose then that can leave the liver and enter the blood, thereby maintaining blood glucose homeostasis. All right, then cells can take up glucose under certain conditions when there is insulin present, and they can take up glucose, and cells can use that to make ATP, which is the energy currency inside the cell. And there are a number of metabolic pathways involved in extracting ATP from glucose. The first one is glycolysis, right? That's just the breaking of glucose into two pieces, the lysis of glucose. And you get 2-3 carbon fragments of pyruvic acid. This can happen under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. It really doesn't matter. And what is the most important thing about this slide that's not on this slide? ATP production, right? So glycolysis does produce some ATP. Does anybody remember how many? Yeah, 2. It actually makes 4, but it takes 2 to get glycolysis going, so you're just left with 2 measly ATP, but that's better than nothing. For some tissues can survive with that. Many tissues cannot, like the brain and the heart. Kidneys can't survive with just that. Okay, after pyruvic acid then, so this is in the cytoplasm, glycolysis takes place in the cytoplasm, pyruvic acid then enters mitochondria under what kind of conditions? Pyruvate is welcome to enter the mitochondria only if oxygen is present under aerobic conditions. And when it does, pyruvic acid then gets decarboxylated and the 2 carbon fragments that are left over are added to acetyl coenzyme A, or coenzyme A to become acetyl coenzyme A. So this is a preparatory reaction, this short arrow right here. It does occur in the mitochondria. That produces 1 CO2, and then the acetyl group enters the Krebs cycle, and this is where we're going to start today. And then in the Krebs cycle, it's going to break that acetyl group down into 2 carbon dioxide. Some more ATP is being made, but also some high-energy electrons are going to be produced. There's some high-energy electrons produced by glycolysis. some by the Krebs cycle, and those high-energy electrons then are transported to the electron transport chain inside the mitochondria. So there is a functional molecule that carries substances from one metabolic reaction to another. So there are high-energy electrons produced by glycolysis. Those high-energy electrons are carried to electron transport chain by something. What do we call those things that carry intermediates around from one metabolic pathway to another? It could be from glycolysis to the electron transport chain, from the preparatory reaction to the electron transport chain, or from the Krebs cycle into the electron transport chain. I'll give you a hint. They're large organic molecules. Coenzymes, that's right. And so what kind of coenzymes are we thinking about, in particular in cellular respiration? It is NAD plus and FADH, right? Those are the oxidized form of those coenzymes, and the reduced form is NADH and FADH2. Okay, so be aware that anytime there's an oxidation reduction reaction, it's a coupled reaction. Something can't be reduced unless something is going the other way, is being oxidized at the exact same time. All right, so this is where we are on the slide. We're just starting the preparatory reaction. So let me scoot down to aerobic respiration. Unless you have a question about the Cori cycle or the fermentation pathway that we talked about, I don't want to take time to review those right now. But if you want me to review those with you, see me during office hours. Or lab instructors are familiar with those. And your SI leader is expert too. Sign-in sheet is going around. Did I pass it out? Oh, good. I didn't want to forget passing it around one more time. All right, so here we start aerobic respiration. What's the organelle where aerobic respiration takes place? Mitochondria. Okay, so under aerobic conditions, pyruvate that's formed by glycolysis can enter the mitochondria, and when it does, it participates in the preparatory reaction to the Krebs cycle. And here's the preparatory reaction. You have pyruvic acid. You don't have to memorize the structure of this compound, but you should at least know that it has how many carbon atoms in the backbone? 3. And that makes perfect sense because glucose has 6, and when you chop glucose in half, you're left with 3. In order to combine with this coenzyme, now what kind of molecule is coenzyme A? How would you describe this? Large organic molecule or small metal ion? It's a large organic molecule because it is what? A coenzyme. Right there in the name. So we're not trying to be tricky. Here, it's just a coenzyme. It's not a cofactor, right? If it was just a simple metal ion, it would be a cofactor. But this is a coenzyme. And what's the job of a coenzyme again? It carries something from one metabolic reaction to another. And what it's going to carry, what coenzyme A carries, is an acetyl group. An acetyl group is a two-carbon group. And we're going to see that as a nice intermediate in a lot of biochemistry inside our bodies. All right, so in order to go from a three-carbon group, pyruvic acid, to an acetyl group, what has to happen? You have to have a decarboxylation that produces one CO2, which is the reason why we exhale when we're breathing, to get rid of that CO2. All right, and in so doing, that releases some energy. So this is an exergonic reaction. It releases energy, and that some of that energy is used to reduce NAD plus into NADH. So the energy form in NADH is in the form of high energy electrons. And NAD, don't forget, is a coenzyme as well. It's a large organic molecule. And what it's carrying are these high energy electrons from the preparatory reaction to, anybody remember that slide that you're drawing out in lab this week? To the electron transport chain. So try to draw an arrow over there. That's where NADH is going to donate its electrons. All right, so we got acetyl coenzyme A. This is the molecule that can enter the Krebs cycle. So we're going to talk about the next metabolic pathway right now, which is Krebs cycle. So far, what have we talked about? Glycolysis last time. We talked about the anaerobic pathway, the LDH reaction of pyruvate being converted into lactic acid. And here's the fourth pathway, which is the preparatory reaction. Now we're going to talk about the fifth one, which is Krebs cycle. So on this slide right here, okay, I see a membrane, and it's got some bumps on it. Right, this is above the membrane, that just signifies the cytoplasm. And inside this membrane right here, that means inside the matrix. And in particular, inside the mitochondria. And in particular, that inner compartment, which is what we call the matrix. Okay, so preparatory reaction happens inside the mitochondria because what enters the mitochondria is pyruvic acid or pyruvate. You have that decarboxylation step, which produces acetyl coenzyme A plus some high energy electrons carried by NADH. All right, that acetyl group, how many carbons in that acetyl group? It says right there on the slide, 2. Okay, combined with a 4-carbon group from oxaloacetic acid, and I'm not going to ask you to know the names of the intermediates of the Krebs cycle. I want you to know just some of the products that are produced by the Krebs cycle. But anyway, you see that if you have a 2-carbon fragment and a 4-carbon fragment joining together, you get a 6-carbon fragment once again, okay, which we call citric acid. This 6-carbon fragment is not glucose molecule. It's a different kind of acid. As a matter of fact, glucose is not even an acid. But that sets up the Krebs cycle to undergo 2 steps of decarboxylation. So 2 more CO2s are produced. Now, how many carbons did we add to the Krebs cycle to get it started? 2. So here are the 2 carbon dioxides that are released. Not exactly the same 2 that were added. That would take a couple turns of the Krebs cycle, but you could think of it as being from acetyl-CoA, right? If there's 2 carbon dioxides being produced, that's because an acetyl group was added to the Krebs cycle. So this thing turns, and remember, chemical energy is stored in the form of chemical bonds in these compounds, so when decarboxylations take place, that releases energy. So the Krebs cycle is an exergonic reaction. And what was one of the things that we learned about exergonic reactions? They're usually coupled in our biochemistry to produce ATP. Because ADP going to ATP is an endergonic reaction. It needs any energy from someplace. And one place where it can get your cells can get energy is through the Krebs cycle, because that's an exergonic reaction. All right, so that's what I want you to know about this. Decarboxylations take place inside the mitochondria, so those organelles produce CO2 that we have to excrete from our bodies, and this only happens under aerobic conditions. Krebs cycle is inside the mitochondria, the preparatory reaction is inside the mitochondria, and glycolysis takes place in the cytoplasm. Okay, and glycolysis can take place under aerobic or anaerobic conditions. It really does not care. And remember, glycolysis produces 2 ATP. There are 2 ways that a cell can produce ATP. One is by substrate level phosphorylation, and another is by oxidative phosphorylation. So just 2 different ways. Right? Oxidative phosphorylation requires what other molecule? Oxygen, just kind of a wild guess, which is true. It requires oxygen. Does glycolysis require oxygen? It doesn't. So that's not oxidative phosphorylation. That's what we call substrate level phosphorylation, just because ATP is produced by enzymatic reactions and not through the electron transport chain, which requires oxygen. We're going to look at ETC toward the end of this lecture. All right, so that's Krebs cycle. Let's look in some detail of what the Krebs cycle produces for us with all those decarboxylations, those 2 decarboxylations, which is an exergonic reaction. Krebs cycle products are 1 GTP, guanosine triphosphate, and that has the exact same energy level or very, very close to ATP. So when you're making a GTP, what are you really making? You're making ATP because there can be a transfer of this phosphate to an ADP, making it an ATP, and that chemical reaction can go backwards and forwards based on what principle? The Le Chatelier's principle or the law of mass action. Okay, so that's how that works. It also produces 3 NADHs. Now, what can you tell me about NADH? Is it a low energy or high energy intermediate? It's high energy. What is it carrying? High energy electrons. Your book says protons. It does carry a proton, but I would like for you to think in terms of high energy electrons. All right, so Krebs cycle produces 3 of these things. Don't forget, NADH is a coenzyme. It's big and organic. The same thing for FADH2. It's carrying high energy electrons, just like NADH. but not quite as high an energy level as NADH, a little bit lower. But still, there's enough energy in this to make ATP for us, and we're going to see how that happens. All right, so NADH, FADH2, carry electrons to ETC, and ETC is where most of the ATP in our bodies is made. Under what kind of conditions? Under aerobic conditions, and we'll see why oxygen is necessary when we get to ETC. So here is the Krebs cycle. All right, so here is acetyl-CoA. You see this two-carbon group joining oxaloacetic acid, which is four carbons. You end up with citric acid, which is six. And then by some rearrangements and other kinds of organic chemistry, wow, you guys are going to love organic chemistry because then you'll see how all this stuff really happens. Okay, there are some decarboxylations. So here is one decarboxylation that releases a lot of energy. Some of that energy is trapped in high energy electrons in NADH, right? So NAD plus is converted to NADH plus a proton right here at this decarboxylation step. Here's the second decarboxylation step. So how many carbons are left in that pyruvate that enter the mitochondria? So here's one, here's two, but don't forget the preparatory reaction also produced one CO2 when it made acetyl coenzyme A. So that's three carbon dioxides that were produced from that one pyruvate. All the carbons are used up. Right? But now there's still some energy left in succinic acid. And when succinic acid is produced, here is a phosphorylation of GDP to GTP. And then that GTP can be used to make an ATP, right? Because the energy level of ATP and GDP are basically the same. That's controlled by, like what we said, the law of mass action. All right, and then getting back to oxaloacetic acid, there is another energy reaction from malic acid. So NAD plus can be converted into or reduced into NADH during this step. All right, so the bottom line is that there are three NADHs produced by one turn of the Krebs cycle. Okay, there is one ATP produced by one turn of the Krebs cycle, and then there's one other step that I forgot to mention. Okay, thank you. There is also one FADH2 produced by one turn of the Krebs cycle. Okay, now one turn of the Krebs cycle is fueled by what molecule? Okay, it's fueled by pyruvic acid. How many carbons are in pyruvic acid? Three. But how many are there in glucose? There's six. So for every glucose, right, then there are two turns of the Krebs cycle. All right. So for every glucose, there are not three NADHs produced by the Krebs cycle, but six. There's not one FADH2 produced. There are two, and then there are two ATP produced for every glucose. So it depends on how people like to talk to you. Right? If they like to talk to you about one turn or two turns only because that means they're thinking about glucose as the original molecule. Okay, notice that some of these reactions are hydrolysis reactions. I can see water being put in here and water being put in here. So don't forget, water is an important intermediate in a lot of biochemistry. It's just not the solvent that we're all dissolved in. It's an important biochemical as well. Okay, so for one turn, it's three NADHs, one ATP, and one FADH2. That's the Krebs cycle. And we said that NADH and FADH2 are coenzymes. What does that mean? They're going to carry some kind of product. They're going to accept the product and carry it to another chemical reaction someplace. And what they are carrying, since NADH is the reduced form of NAD, they're carrying high energy electrons. Electrons that have a lot of free energy associated with them. And it just so happens that there are some molecules that are oxidized. In particular, FMN is a protein in the Christi membrane. It's the inner membrane of a mitochondria. Maybe I'd like to change the slide a little bit by showing you a drawing of a mitochondria, but you're going to have to think of a mitochondria in your mind. Remember, there are two membranes. There's an outer membrane and then an inner membrane, which is the Christi membrane. Well, these proteins that we see right here, FMN and coenzyme Q and cytochromes, these are all embedded in the inner membrane. But that's okay because NADH has access to the inner membrane because it's already inside the mitochondria. So NADH is reduced form. It can donate those electrons to FMN. then FMN becomes FMNH2. All right, so when it goes from FMN to FMNH2, okay, what happens? What's happening right here? FMNH2 is what form of this protein? It's the reduced form because it has accepted those electrons from NADH. Okay. All right, so then there are neighboring proteins in the membrane. FMNH can donate electrons to another electron acceptor, coenzyme Q, and then it goes from an oxidized to a reduced form. But if we look at this, not just in a biochemical pathway, but as a table, as a graph of energy level versus the progress of this biochemistry, what can you say about cytochrome A3 energy level compared to coenzyme Q? It's lower, right? So these electrons want to flow from high energy to low energy, right? And when going from high energy to low energy, what kind of reaction is that? Exergonic or endergonic? That's exergonic. So electron transport chain is an exergonic set of oxidation reduction reactions. And what did we say about a series of exergonic reactions? It can be used to make ATP. And indeed, if we look at ETC, right, they're all oxidation reduction reactions. So when cytochrome Q becomes reduced, okay, when it becomes reduced, what does that mean? Well, it means that FMNH2 has got to be oxidized. But there's something else that can happen. All right, we have FADH2 can also reduce coenzyme Q. All right, so what is the energy level of FADH2 compared to NADH? Clearly shown on this chart right here is that it's a lower energy. All right, and the high energy electrons from FADH2 contribute to the electron transport chain, but it misses this step right here, so it cannot make that ATP. So this is why one NADH can produce 1, 2, 3 ATPs, but high energy electrons in FADH2 can only produce 1, 2 ATPs. So that's what I want you to memorize. Your book goes into some detail about how, under all conditions, that's not necessarily true, but I would just like for you to memorize those two numbers. The amount of ATP that's produced for every NADH is 1, 2, 3, corresponds nicely to this diagram. The number of ATP for every FADH2 is only 2 because these electrons at a little bit lower energy level compared to NADH. All right, so not all cells operate under the same physiologic conditions. So sometimes maybe a cell will make 2.5 ATPs for every NADH, maybe 2.75 or 2.8, or maybe under certain conditions 1.75. There's a whole range, okay, and scientists and physicians will be debating that right for the next 1,000 years, but I got to give you a grade before that 1,000 years is up. So we're going to define in this class, okay, 3 for NADH, 2 ATPs for an FADH2. But realize that this is under ideal conditions, and there might not be even a single cell in your body that's operating under ideal, absolutely ideal conditions. All right, so you see flowing through these different cytochromes right here is an entity that we call electrons, right? A little particle with a negative charge. These electrons can have different energy levels, and they're always going to flow from high energy to low energy. They will never flow backwards. And if all of cytochrome C1 right here is in the reduced state, because electrons can't jump from cytochrome C1 to cytochrome A, right, then all of the cytochrome C1 is in the reduced state, it can no longer accept the electrons from cytochrome B. And if that happens, then electrons can't flow through the electron transport chain, and if electrons can't flow through, what happens to this ATP production? It stops. Right, so if there's a blockage in flow of electrons anywhere through ETC, the production of ATP stops. And if that happens, then our brains have about 2 or 3 seconds worth of consciousness, and then about 2 or 3 minutes of life, and then the brain dies as a result of that. So this is a very important metabolic pathway. You have seconds and then minutes right, to reestablish blood flow to somebody's brain. So what maintains the flow of electrons through the ETC, and that is, let's look way down here at the very bottom energy level, we have oxygen, O2. That's the final electron acceptor. So in order to make all these ATP, we need to have oxygen in our bodies, and in particular mitochondria. And how do we get that oxygen in there? We inhale, okay, and then just by concentration gradient, oxygen moves by diffusion into the mitochondria. Don't forget, mitochondria then produce something, a waste product, which is carbon dioxide, and we exhale that out of our bodies, and that works basically just by diffusion as well, by concentration gradient, because carbon dioxide is almost zero concentration in the atmosphere. So if somebody asks you, what is the last product that is produced, that's okay to say that, okay, product produced by the electron transport chain, what's the very last product that's produced? Ah, look at that super magic molecule once again, is water, okay, because it combines with electrons and protons that it got from metabolism of glycolysis and the Krebs cycle and the preparatory reaction. As it's running through ETC, it combines with oxygen to make water. So what allows these electrons to move through electron transport chain is oxygen. Without oxygen accepting those electrons, then all of the flow through ETC will stop, and then the production of ATP will stop, and that's terrible when that happens. Okay? So that's the important thing. All of these things are located on the Christi membrane, the inner membrane of a mitochondria. All right, so I'm going to stop and just think for a second if there's something that I missed. And I'll look and see if anybody has any questions. But I can't think of anything that I want to say more at this time. Other than ETC is what? A series of oxidation reduction reactions where high energy electrons are passed from one molecule to another, to another, to another. And as they go from one molecule to another, they decrease in energy level, which means that's an exergonic step. That exergonic reaction can be used to run an endergonic reaction, which is the combining of ADP and inorganic phosphate to make ATP. Okay? Because we can't create energy, can't destroy energy, it only can be converted from one form to another. Okay, so that's why oxygen is present. So you don't ever want to mess with these cytochromes right here and get them messed up. All right, so NADH and FADH2 from Krebs, as well as from glycolysis, carry electrons to ETC, and then these high electrons are shuttled in sequence through ETC. That regenerates NAD+, regenerates FAD, and then that can be used to run glycolysis and also the Krebs cycle, because in order for the Krebs cycle to turn, you need to have NAD+ to accept electrons. Right, so that's important. So if we stop ETC, then we stop the Krebs cycle as well. Okay. All right. So because oxygen is necessary right here, the production of ATP coupled to ETC is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. It is not substrate level phosphorylation. All right. So oxidative phosphorylation, what happens? Where does it happen? In what organelle? The mitochondria, in particular the Christi membrane. All right, so that energy is used to phosphorylate ADP to make it ATP. All right, so that's all I think I need to say about ETC, except for this exam figure right here. It's an artist's representation of how the flow of electrons through the Christi membrane, through all these cytochromes, can be used to make ATP. And there are a number of really nice Nobel Prizes that were won by people. I'm not sure I ever talked to them. But anyway, this is really interesting how they were able to figure this out. So let's see if I can explain it well enough for you to get an impression of what's going on here. Okay, so this is not substrate level phosphorylation. This is oxidative phosphorylation, which means it's set up by having oxygen to accept those electrons that are flowing through the electron transport chain. All right, so here's NADH, which is a reduced form of NADH. It can release its high-energy electrons to a protein, and when that protein releases those high-energy electrons, right, when it becomes reduced, it becomes energized. So this protein right here, because it receives energy from NADH, can take a proton actually 4 protons from the matrix, which is the inner space in a membrane, and move it from a low concentration in the matrix to a high concentration in the intermembrane space. Well, what can you tell me about going from low concentration to high concentration? Is that active or passive? That's active. And it gets that energy from this oxidation reduction reaction, from those electrons flowing through these different proteins embedded in the Christie membrane. All right, and since it requires energy for these protons to go from low to high concentration, then these electrons then have to give up energy, right? Because you can't create or destroy energy. So now you have a high concentration of protons in the inner membrane space, low concentration in the matrix. And that's not a very stable state, because what do all these protons in the inner membrane space want to do? They want to go back into the matrix. But right now they can't. They're trapped because that's a nice phospholipid bilayer. All right, let's continue with these electrons. So it flips from one molecule to another, bumps into another cytochrome right here, which is also a pump. So it accepts some high energy electrons and passes them on as lower energy. Some of that energy is used to pump even more protons from low concentration to high concentration. So now this inner membrane space is becoming even more acidic, higher concentration. But those electrons aren't done yet. Okay, they produce some more oxidation reduction reactions and go through a third pump, which then pumps even some more protons into the intermembrane space. So now we have a super high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, low concentration of protons in the matrix. So what do all these protons now really love to do? They like to go from high concentration to low concentration. And what did we say about a gradient, a chemical gradient, or maybe an electrical gradient? You should think of it as a form of energy. A gradient is a form of energy. And if you have a gradient of electrons, we call that a, what do we call when you have a device that can, a battery, then that's a battery, yeah, that we use to power our cell phones and things like that. So energy can be used to do work. So here you don't have, well, I suppose because protons have a plus charge, that almost kind of, there's an electrochemical gradient, right? That is some form of a battery right here, but think of it mostly as a chemical gradient, right? So protons can go back into the matrix, not through the membrane, but through another special protein. And this protein is so big that you can see it with an electron microscope. All right, and this is what it is right here. It's a channel as well as an ATP synthase. Sometimes we call this an ATP synthetase. So as protons go from a high energy to low energy, it gives up some energy. All right, so when it goes from high concentration to low concentration, that's just by diffusion, right? That's a passive process. If it passes through this respiratory complex right here, then there is an ATPase that can take ADP inorganic phosphate and put them together to make ATP as protons flow through this channel to equalize the concentration. Because remember, there is energy in the concentration gradient. That energy, by using this protein, we call that a respiratory assembly right here, can convert ADP and inorganic phosphate into ATP. Now, what's the molecule that's necessary to make all of this happen? Oxygen. So that's why we call this oxidative phosphorylation. And in particular, this diagram right here is kind of nicely set up. How many proton pumps do you see? You see 3, and if it's NADH, just remember how many ATPs that are produced? 3. That's kind of a loose artist's interpretation, but it's easy to remember. Okay. FADH is going to donate electrons right before the second pump, not the first pump. So it's only going to produce 2 ATPs. Okay? So that's one way of thinking of it. So this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory of how oxidative phosphorylation works. This ATP is produced not by substrate level phosphorylation, but by the flow of protons through the Christie membrane from the intermembrane space. And when those protons flow through this respiratory assembly, it releases enough energy for this protein to actually couple ADP and inorganic phosphate together to make an ATP. All right, so for every NADH that's in the mitochondria, how many ATP can it make? 1, 2, 3. And for FADH, it's 1, 2. So now we just kind of have to tally up from everything that we know about glycolysis and the preparatory reaction in the Krebs cycle, how many total ATP can be produced by, I don't know, what molecule do you like as the benchmark? Do you like pyruvate or glucose? I like glucose. Okay, so we'll think of glucose. But remember, if we're going to use glucose, how many terms of the Krebs cycle?
Two.
There's two, right. All right, so I think I talked about all this. What's the last molecule that's produced by the electron transport chain?
Water,
that's right, because it's going to combine with those high-energy electrons. All right, so we said that ATP can be made by two different ways, direct versus oxidative phosphorylation. I don't like direct so much. I like substrate-level phosphorylation, okay, where ATP is generated when bonds break by rearranging things with an enzymatic reaction. Both ATPs and glycolysis are made this way. That's a substrate-level phosphorylation. And glycolysis can take place under aerobic and anaerobic conditions. Right? So even when the cell is not in a very healthy state, at least a couple, two ATPs can be made. But the ATPs that are made by the Krebs cycle are also substrate-level phosphorylation. Now, the Krebs cycle operates under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic or aerobic? Only aerobic conditions. Right? So substrate-level phosphorylation doesn't mean aerobic or anaerobic respiration. It just means how the ATP is produced. Okay? Because Krebs cycle is dependent on oxygen. Otherwise, metabolites build up, and because of Le Chatelier's principle, that will back the Krebs cycle up, and the Krebs cycle has to go in the forward direction to make those two ATPs. All right, oxidative phosphorylation, on the other hand, is produced by using those high-energy electrons that are carried by FADH2 and NADH from various metabolic pathways, glycolysis, the preparatory reaction, and Krebs cycle, then donate those electrons to ETC, and if we add it all up, it's going to produce 30-some ATPs for every glucose. This is oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so I think I talked about all this already. Oh, yeah. So 36 to 38 is a good ballpark number for you to know. This 30 to 32 is under realistic conditions. 36 to 38 is more ideal conditions. And that's what I want you to know. All right, so as high-energy electrons pass through ETC, okay, aerobic respiration produces about 38 to 36 ATP for every glucose molecule under aerobic conditions. Now, how many ATPs are produced by glycolysis under anaerobic conditions?
Two.
So that's really the take-home message. Okay, anaerobic conditions produce 2 ATP for you for every glucose, while oxidative phosphorylation can generate 30-something, on the high side of 30. All right, so on a test, that's what I would ask. I'm not going to ask you, is it 36 or 35 or 37 or 38? It's going to be 30-something versus what?
2.
Okay, that's the big take-home message. And, of course, in some organs, that's the difference between life and death. Okay, so this slide, I don't know if I made this slide or not, but this is what I want you to remember. 3 ATPs for every NADH2, for every FADH2. Okay. So here is a pretty good synopsis, this table, 5.2. But you know, you're going to have to change some things around a little bit. Let's talk about what you have to change around. All right, with glucose going to pyruvate, you should know where that happens. Cytoplasm, not in the mitochondria. You get a net gain of 2 ATP. Maybe somewhere in your mind you have a picture of where that is. It's going to make 4, but it takes 2 to get it going, right? So that's a net of 2. But it also produces 2 NADHs as well. And you can go back and look at those steps. Remember, that's high-energy electrons that can be used to make more ATP with what metabolic pathway? Electron transport chain, okay? But now where is that electron transport chain? We said that these NADHs are in the cytoplasm. They're in the mitochondria. All right, and there's a high concentration of NADH inside the mitochondria, so guess what? It takes a little bit of energy to get those NADHs that are in the cytoplasm into the mitochondria, and as NADH enters the mitochondria, that energy is transferred to FADH2. What can you tell me about FADH2 compared to the energy level of NADH? It's a little bit lower. So the NADHs that are produced in the cytoplasm don't make as many ATP as those that are produced inside the mitochondria by Krebs cycle or the preparatory reaction. We discount it by one. All right, so for every FADH2, this number right here, I want you to change to 2. Remember, every FADH produces how many ATP for this class?
2.
So put 2, right, then these numbers are going to change a little bit, but not too drastically for the concept of what I want to cover in this class. So these NADHs produced by glycolysis in the cytoplasm, okay, don't make 3 ATPs, they only make 2, okay? But what does glycolysis do? It takes glucose and splits it into 2. That's why you have this number right here, okay? So instead of 2 times 1.5, you're going to have 2 times 2, which is 4, okay? Just a little modification. I think it's a little bit simpler. Here's that preparatory reaction, pyruvate going to acetyl-CoA. Now, where does this take place? In the mitochondria, right, under aerobic conditions. Pyruvate can't even enter the mitochondria unless oxygen is present, right? And and this preparatory reaction produces one NADH, okay? But how many pyruvates are there in the glucose? There's 2. Right, this NADH is inside the mitochondria already. It doesn't have to lose energy to donate electrons to ETC. So then we have 3 ATPs times 2. Right, there's going to be 6 for the preparatory reaction. Krebs cycle. Right, where is Krebs cycle located? Mitochondria. Right, so glycolysis, cytoplasm, preparatory reaction, wait, I don't know if I said that right. Let me go back. Glycolysis, cytoplasm. Preparatory reaction, mitochondria, Krebs cycle, mitochondria. All right, and we see that with one turn of the Krebs cycle, it produces a GTP, which is converted into ATP. But remember, how many turns of Krebs cycle is there for every glucose?
2.
All right, so that produces 2 ATP. It produces 3 NADHs, 1 NFADH2. But remember, there's 2 turns of the Krebs cycle for every glucose, so we're measuring it against glucose and not pyruvate. Then you can recalculate by putting a 3 here and a 2 here. All right, and so if we want to now look at the totals, all right, we see 30-something ATPs produced by aerobic respiration, oxidative phosphorylation, okay, versus just 2 ATPs by glycolysis under anaerobic conditions. So 30-something versus 2. This right here just says substrate-level phosphorylation. Some substrate-level phosphorylation happens under anaerobic conditions in the cytoplasm during glycolysis. Some substrate-level phosphorylation occurs under aerobic conditions in the Krebs cycle. But remember, substrate-level phosphorylation does not absolutely require the electron transport chain to be operating. Okay, it's just an enzymatic reaction, either the Krebs cycle or glycolysis. In order to make all of these ATP by oxidative phosphorylation, that's when you need, of course, oxygen, but you also need to have the ETC operational as well. All right, so what's better for you, anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration? Yeah, I'd take aerobic respiration any day, right? Like if you go to the gas station, you could pick 2 gas stations, and you know one gas station and the price of gas is going to be the same, $5 at either place that you go. Okay, you know, one gas station, you're going to get 2 miles per gallon, and a second gas station, you're going to get 36 miles per gallon. What gas station are you going to go to? Yeah, 36, right? It's a lot more efficient. Same thing, that's the beauty of mitochondria in our bodies. It produces ATP very efficiently through oxidative phosphorylation under most conditions. I think I get to talk about a little something here for those that are kind of following my lecture. Okay. I know you're going to have to maybe listen to this and listen to it again, read your chapter, work some questions, because just like I can't tell you everything in one lecture, you can't listen and learn everything with just listening to me talk one time too. So I know you got to piece a lot of information together. But talk to your lab instructors, talk to me during office hours. All right, but let's look at this chemiosmotic theory one more time. All right, so as electrons flow through ETC, it pumps protons from the matrix into the intermembrane space. So there's a high concentration gradient. There's a form of energy in that concentration gradient, which can be used to make ATP. As long as what molecule is available? And I'm pointing to it right here.
Oxygen.
Oxygen. What's the last molecule formed?
Water.
Okay. Now, not every cell is healthy. Okay, maybe you have peripheral vascular disease, or maybe you have blockage of an artery in your heart, or blockage of an artery in your brain. Okay, or maybe your heart stops beating, so now you don't have oxygen anywhere in your body. What is going to happen to this mitochondria? Okay, let's take a look at this, and this is going to be some advancement in medicine when we figure out how to do it. I don't know if anybody's figured out how to do it yet, but maybe if somebody has, it'd be great. It wouldn't surprise me, because I don't know everything that's going on. All right, what does a mitochondria love to do? Where does it like to push protons? Where does it like to have protons? And don't forget, this mitochondria is like a different organism inside your body, right? Because of the endosymbiont theory, this is like a old, ancient kind of bacteria that formed a symbiosis with our cells. And this bacteria likes to have protons at a high concentration in this intermembrane space, right? That's how it evolved. That's what it loves to do. And it can use these electrons to maintain that high proton concentration in the intermembrane space. But what happens if our bodies start to misbehave and we don't have oxygen? Well, the mitochondria doesn't change who it is. It still wants to have high protons in this intermembrane space. Okay? But when that happens, all right, then if all the protons go through the ATP synthetase, then there's low proton concentration in the intermembrane space. So the mitochondria is very unhappy. So guess what it likes to do? It likes to pump protons back into the space, but these pumps right here aren't working. But that's okay, because here is a pump right here. So what can this pump do? It can take ATP, use it up and make ADP, and it can take these protons and make them go in the reverse direction. So what is that doing for your cells then? It's further depleting your cells of ATP as a result. So under aerobic conditions, mitochondria are very beneficial to us. But under anaerobic conditions, they probably hurt us a lot by using up ATP, even though our cells aren't metabolically active. So if there's some way that we could turn this enzyme off when somebody's having a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, we could probably preserve their brain function and heart function for a lot longer period of time. Okay, because the mitochondria like to have high protons in this intermembrane space, no matter if it's aerobic or anaerobic conditions. And if anybody knows how to do, maybe you know how to do that, tell me how to do that. That would be wonderful. Okay. All right, so that's the chemiosmotic theory. And I would be happy to stop and answer some questions or something about that, but I'm sure you're going to have to go home and read the chapter maybe 5 times, work some of those problems, work the online questions, listen to the lecture again. I believe my recorder's working. If it's not, go back to the previous semester. So this lecture is probably better than last semester. Okay? All right. But nonetheless, all right, to recapitulate everything, okay, what is a good slide that you should just have committed to memory? This one right here, because you've got glycolysis, you got the preparatory reaction, you got the Krebs cycle, electron transport. Of course, there's some important things left off this slide, like ATP production. Another thing that's left off over here is that oxygen has to be available, but it's sort of encoded in this term right here, because aerobic means in the presence of oxygen. And the waste product that is produced is CO2, and the energy molecule that's put into cellular respiration to get it to work is glucose, mostly. Okay, some tissues can maybe work with some other kinds of compounds. All right, here is that glycolysis again. Don't forget, 1, 2 NADHs are produced by glycolysis, so you got to go back and maybe look at some of these things, but you don't have to draw glycolysis out, unless you're taking a biochemistry class. The other thing that's kind of confusing, doesn't go over very well in the book, make sure you know the difference between gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis is what? Going from pyruvate to glucose. Glycogenolysis is going from glycogen to glucose. Glycogenesis is going from glucose to glycogen, and then going from glucose to pyruvic acid is? Yeah, it's real boring. That's just glycolysis. Right? You're familiar with glycolysis now. Okay. So you'll need reading glasses to answer those questions in the textbook and also on the test. So pronounce those words out. Practice spelling them so you become familiar with them, because they actually look the same and sound the same, but they're drastically different metabolic pathways. All right, fat and protein metabolism. What can I say about this? Fats can be hydrolyzed to glycerol and fatty acids. Yeah, because you've built a triglyceride before, right? A triglyceride is glycerol and three fatty acids. And what kind of process is used to make a triglyceride from those building blocks? Yeah, dehydration synthesis reaction. So if you want to break a triglyceride down, you don't use a dehydration synthesis reaction, you use a hydrolysis reaction, which we say on this slide right here. And then some of these products can be broken down further. They can be modified and then put through the Krebs cycle, which then generates high energy electrons that can be donated to ETC to make what? ATP out of. Okay, so some of these other sources like fats and proteins can be used by using the Krebs cycle to make ATP. So proteins can be broken down to amino acids. That's the building block, right? So you got to know the building block of a triglyceride. You got to know the building block of a protein. These amino acids have a carboxyl group. They have an amino group. That amino group can be taken off. We call that deamination. And the carbon backbone of those amino acids can be run through the Krebs cycle to generate high energy electrons for us, which is another way of saying making ATP, right? All right, so these metabolic pathways, I want to read this statement because it's in your book. It's not exactly true. These pathways can be used to interconvert carbohydrates to fats and proteins. This is really not exactly true. Once something is a fat, it cannot be converted into any other biochemical. So fat cannot be converted into a carbohydrate. A fat cannot be converted into a protein. Proteins can be converted into fats. Carbohydrates can be converted into fats, but once something is a fat, it's always going to be a fat. Your body just wants to store it in that energy form, and it doesn't want to lose that energy. Maybe I can describe why that is. Okay, so what do we have right here? All right, when more energy is taken in than consumed, like for instance taken in by diet, then which is consumed by exercise, glucose is converted into glycogen and fat. So here you have when energy is taken in, for instance, in glucose. So here's glucose coming in. All right, that can be converted into glycogen when you are in a positive energy balance, when you have more energy in your body than you need, then that glucose is stored in glycogen. Or it can be run through the first couple steps of glycolysis, can be broken in half to a molecule we call glycerol, and that is one building block for a triglyceride. If glycolysis is allowed to proceed all the way to the end, and acetyl coenzyme A is made, then this acetyl coenzyme A, how many carbons are in this acetyl group? Two. That acetyl coenzyme A can be used to make a fatty acid. But how many carbons at a time? Just two at a time. So fatty acids have 6 carbons, 8 carbons, 12 carbons, 14 carbons, but there's not an odd number. Our body cannot make an odd number of carbon chains to make a fatty acid. So by running glycolysis, now we have both of the building blocks to make a triglyceride, and our body can make fat out of it. Okay. Now, going back to this step number 2, this acetyl-CoA, what are its possible fates? Well, how many arrows do you see between the step between acetyl-CoA and pyruvic acid? I only see one arrow. And that's a one-way step right there. Acetyl-CoA can never be converted back to pyruvate because you'd have to carboxylate it. You'd have to get a carbon atom and join it to other carbon atoms. And the only living organisms that can do that are plants in the form of light energy, right? Animals can't do this step right here. Okay, so that acetyl-CoA then can go into the Krebs cycle, and then all of those carbons end up in CO2. Another possible fate for this 2-carbon fragment is that it can be joined with another 2-carbon fragment and another one, making it a fatty acid. That fatty acid then can be incorporated into a fat. So once you have a 2-carbon fragment right here, namely this acetyl group, it can be used to make a fat or it can be used to make energy. Those are the only 2 possible fates for it. And these intermediates of the Krebs cycle are based on sugar molecules. So in order for you to use acetyl-CoA as an energy source, you need to have some sugars in your diet. If there are no sugars in your diet, then the Krebs cycle intermediates get depleted, All right, and you're stuck with a lot of this acetyl coenzyme A, which can be used to make fatty acids, or they can be recombined to what we call ketone bodies, like acetone and other kinds of highly volatile chemicals, which then you can breathe out of your body because they're very, very volatile. Like acetone is what you have in fingernail polish remover, and if you pour that on the table, what happens to it? It evaporates almost immediately, right? Because it's very, that's what I mean by volatile. Okay, so once something is a fat, it's trapped as a fat always because the only way your body can deal with it is as a two-carbon fragment. Okay, so I know there's a couple diets around. I don't know if people still talk about them or not, but you ever hear of an Atkins diet? Okay, Atkins diet is when you don't have sugars in your diet, which means then that the Krebs cycle is shut down. Your body tries to make energy by using fatty acids, by converting them into acetyl-CoA. We'll see that there is a way to get some ATP by this process of going from a fatty acid to acetyl-CoA. But basically then, the Krebs cycle is shut down. Not a lot of NADHs are produced, so a person's available energy is way reduced when they're on that kind of a diet, the Atkins diet, because the Krebs cycle shuts down, which also kind of mimics another condition. What's another condition where cells are running out of glucose? Like for diabetes mellitus, glucose can't leave the blood to get into cells. And if glucose can't leave the blood to get into cells, that also shuts down the Krebs cycle. And so the Atkins diet is like an artificially induced diabetes mellitus condition. Okay. So I would recommend when people are taking a really rigorous class like a chemistry or math or maybe even physiology, do not go on an Atkins diet because you won't have enough ATP in your brain to make it function properly. And indeed, if somebody's not following the Atkins diet perfectly, they'll get really dingy. They'll drive on the left-hand side of the road or they'll look at a stoplight and not even know what it is, right? So you got to be really careful. Certainly don't take an exam in here under those conditions. All right, so the next slide right here. So here's that acetyl-CoA. It's a two-carbon fragment. It can be used to make energy with a Krebs cycle, can be converted into ketone bodies that you just exhale out of your body, can be used to make other lipids like cholesterol or fatty acids, but it cannot be used to make proteins and sugars. And if you don't have sugars in your diet, then the Krebs cycle can't even work either. Okay, so that's the kind of the really the beautiful thing about the Atkins diet, because where does this acetyl-CoA come from? Let's go back to this slide. Acetyl-CoA can come from fatty acids, which come from fat, right? So if somebody's on the Atkins diet, then they're going to convert fat into fatty acids. Fatty acids will be converted into acetyl-CoA. And then looking at the next slide, what happens to that acetyl-CoA? Turns into ketone bodies that you just breathe out of your body. So when somebody's on an Atkins diet, they're just breathing fat right out of their body. That's much better than exercising. Okay, but what are the trade-offs? Oh, you might go through a red light, right? You might drive on the wrong side of the road. So there are consequences to messing with your metabolism like that. All right, so hopefully I can give you a little idea of how exciting biochemistry can really be even in your everyday life. Okay. Oh, the other thing I want to talk about on this slide right here, when you take fat and convert it to glycerol and fatty acids, the enzyme that's responsible for that is a lipase. Okay, when you take a fatty acid and convert it into acetyl-CoA, that's not a lipase. It kind of sounds like it should be a lipase, but it's an enzymatic pathway that we call beta oxidation. So over here, this dotted line, we're going to put beta oxidation. This dotted line over here, we're going to say lipase. All right, so lipase is just a hydrolysis reaction. Okay, beta oxidation is a different kind of set of chemical reactions, which we got to talk about a little bit. Okay, not in a whole lot of detail, but a little bit of detail. Acetyl-CoAs can be linked together to form fatty acids, like we saw, nice storage form of energy. This occurs in adipose and liver tissues. Fat is a major form of energy storage in the body. For every gram of triglycerides, you have 9 kilocalories of energy. For every gram of carbohydrates and proteins, you only have about 4 kilocalories. All right, so if you're starving to death, where would you like to get your energy from? by eating the same amount of food, the same weight of food, there's a lot more energy in fat, okay? And various cultures know that. Which also means, though, if you want to lose weight, what kind of food substance should you restrict in your diet? I mean, just in terms of general energy balance, it would be fat primarily because weight for weight, there's a lot more energy in fat compared to carbohydrates and proteins. Okay. Lipolysis, the breakdown of fat into fatty acids and glycerol, like we saw on that slide. Lipase is the enzyme. Hydrolysis reaction results. Right, acetyl-CoAs from free fatty acids serve as a major energy source in major tissues, but that's not catalyzed by lipase. Acetyl-CoAs from fatty acids are produced by beta oxidation, okay, which you labeled on one of those previous slides. So this is beta oxidation. Triglycerides to fatty acids is lipase. Fatty acids to acetyl-CoAs is beta oxidation. And although nobody asked, I knew you all wanted to ask and say, well, what's beta oxidation? Okay, and I think that might be one of the last slides right here. Let me just flip through a couple slides. Oh, that is the last slide. Okay. Let's talk about beta oxidation. Beta oxidation is used to metabolize fatty acids to generate ATP for us. So not only is glucose used to make ATP, but fatty acids can as well. And this occurs under aerobic conditions in the mitochondria. Okay, so aerobic conditions inside the mitochondria, beta oxidation, and it tells you in the name, oxidation, so it requires oxygen. Beta oxidation clips a fatty acid into little pieces, and it clips a fatty acid into pieces of two carbon fragments at a time. So it's going to break off two carbons. So a fatty acid could have 20 carbons in this very long chain, and it's going to clip off two at a time. Can't clip off three, can't clip off one, four, nothing like that, only two. Okay, so let's take a look. Here we have a fatty acid, but remember this fatty acid could have as many as 20 or 26 carbons, not just three that's on this diagram, but three on this diagram is enough to show you how it's going to work. And a fatty acid has a carboxyl group, and the rest is just what, a long hydrocarbon chain. Right, here's that carboxyl group, which allows it to become activated. Coenzyme A is what kind of molecule? It's a coenzyme. It's a large organic molecule. It's going to carry another molecule from one set of chemical reactions to another. What molecule is it going to carry around? A two-carbon fragment, namely an acetyl group. So an acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment. So coenzyme A is going to combine with this fatty acid, and it's going to take away these two carbons right here. Here's the carboxyl carbon. The one next to it is called the alpha carbon. The one next to that is called the beta carbon, and because that's, you could have called that one and two or whatever, but that's just a standard chemistry nomenclature. Here's alpha and beta, and because that's the beta carbon, and this bond right here is the beta bond, then we call this beta oxidation. Okay. All right, so this first step requires ATP. Right, for the fatty acid to combine with coenzyme A. So that is an, right, so this is an endergonic reaction. Going from this step to this step requires energy in the form of ATP. So that's not making ATP for us, that's actually using up some ATP, or the energy in ATP. It's not phosphorylated, it just joins this coenzyme to the fatty acid. But some of that energy then is stored in the fatty acid coenzyme complex, and you can see that signified by this little squiggly little line right here, that provides the activation energy for this reaction to proceed. And then some rearrangements take place, and in the process of these rearrangements and the splitting of carbon bonds, we get an FADH2 produced. Okay, going from this step to this step, and then an NADH produced. So with beta oxidation, okay, every round of beta oxidation produces an FADH2 and an NADH. And when that happens, you end up with an acetyl coenzyme A. Okay, and that acetyl coenzyme A can then be used to run the Krebs cycle. That's already past the preparatory reaction, but this acetyl group can be used to be donated to the Krebs cycle, and then all of the energy can be harvested with that acetyl group in the Krebs cycle that we talked about. The other thing that happens is that it splits away from the fatty acid, so now it's two carbon atoms shorter. Right? But there's still enough energy so that it can combine with coenzyme A again. It doesn't need an ATP. And this process, this cycle, can go over and over and over again until the fatty acid is completely broken down completely into two carbon units. All right, and each time it does, it produces an FADH2 and an NADH. How many ATPs? This is going to be inside the mitochondria because that's where beta oxidation takes place. Okay, we're going to say two ATPs, okay, and for every NADH, we're going to say three ATPs, just to make all the diagrams match up really nicely. But you should be aware that those are under the most ideal conditions inside the cell, which is fine for me. Okay. So you can see a lot of FADHs and NADHs are produced. You have a homework assignment at the end of the chapter to calculate how many of these things are produced with a 20-carbon fatty acid. And then you know how many ATPs are produced. So then you can calculate the number of ATP that's produced for a fatty acid with a carbon length of 20. So you just got to go back and study that. And instead of 30-something for glucose, you're going to see that for a fatty acid, it's going to be on the order of 100 ATPs because of beta oxidation, which just then also kind of underscores how important an energy storage form fats are in our body compared to glucose. Another reason why, and I think you should understand this biochemistry too, actually it's physical chemistry, when we store glucose, remember it's a polar molecule. Glycogen is a polar molecule. So when you store glucose, what other molecule do you have to add to it in order to store it? Since it's a polar molecule, you have to add water to it. And when you add water to something, does it get lighter or heavier? Does it get bigger or smaller? It gets bigger and heavier. So when you store energy in the form of glucose, it's bigger and it's heavier. But when you store a triglyceride is a hydrophobic molecule, can you add water to it? No, it's stored in an anhydrous form. So when you store energy as a lipid, it's very efficient because it's a lot lighter and you don't have to add water to it. It's a lot lighter and smaller as well. It's a very efficient form of storing energy. Okay. All right, so that's it for cell respiration. So go home and, over the weekend, study a lot. Come back on Tuesday and ask a lot of questions. Hopefully I've got some good exercises in Blackboard for you. And I was able to finish the lecture today. I'm really pleased. Okay, I'm going to turn off my recorder.